Here we are at the end of August. How the heck did that happen? I don't know. Where'd the weather go? We had some pretty hot and humid weather coming up this week. It's not going to last long. And with Labor Day feeling like the end of summer, you know, you may be wondering what's in store for you as we ease into fall. So we always enjoy our monthly visit with the weather guys from UW-Madison. Steve Ackerman directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. Great to have you with us, Steve.
It's great to be here.
And John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. John, great to see you.
Good to see you, Larry, but I'm no longer chair.
Oh,
my first day not being chair in almost 10 years.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Boy, I know how that feels. I just went through that same feeling.
Did you?
Yeah. July 1st, I was no longer chair.
It's a good feeling, isn't it?
Oh, man, what a relief.
Yeah, it is. It is.
These guys have big smiles on their faces.
And my hair is growing again.
Yeah, I had a couple of things that, you know, people called me, oh, you got to clean this up, you got to clean that up. I don't want to do that.
Yeah. Somebody else clean up on aisle four.
The J train has left the station.
Oh, man. Well, what about this weather?
Pretty dry August.
Yeah.
For us.
Yeah.
I mean,
and cold, too. It was like 2 or 3 degrees below normal, too.
Yeah.
Because of the clouds, probably.
I think that's probably right. Yeah. And yet, here we are, and, you know, it's hard to talk about all those things today. It feels so soupy out there. And really hot, but the whole month overall has not been like that. It's been a really weird month.
Yeah, and it's dry as a bone. Well, we did get an inch of rain in the southern part of the state here, or an inch or to 2 inches.
I got about an inch and a tenth in my house on, what was that?
Thursday morning.
Yeah, that nice storm.
And we had a really dark morning. It was just almost like midnight at 9 a.m. That was quite unusual for the summer. And though, you know, usually in the summertime you get 3 or 4 or 5 of them maybe, but we've only had that one that I can recall.
Yeah. What did we have for, did we have much in the way of tornado activity? I was trying to think.
Well, I think that week there was a little bit of tornado activity.
Yes, there was a couple,
in the central part of the state. There were some, I don't know if there was a loss of life, but there was a lot of damage.
Yeah.
And the governor was up there, I think, and it just was below the FEMA level of disaster relief, and I think the governor did something in the state to help people out.
Yeah, because there was a lot of damage. But overall, are we down in the number of tornadoes?
I think so. I think that's correct. That's nationwide, too, if I'm not wrong.
Right. Yeah. We're dealing with fires nationwide.
Yeah, that's right.
Anything else.
Yeah, and what are we looking for in the fall forecast? I mean, what's the...
The fall forecast in terms of temperature is looking for an above average temperature. And again, this is NOAA's outlook, which generally is pretty good in temperature-wise. And precipitation, again, it's one of those situations where we don't have a strong global signature going on like an El Nino. So it's equal chances of above, below, or at normal in terms of precipitation. But the three-month fall outlook is above normal. And I've seen trees already turning, so they must have been still stressed from last year's
and the year before,
and so it's really, it's kind of odd. It was depressing because it was so cool
and
you
wet,
and
maybe it's a flash drought that gets some of those species. You know, like the one we've had, it hasn't been prolonged so much, but it turned over at the end of July and it really hasn't rained.
Yeah,
I don't know if that does it to some tree species or not.
Yeah. You mentioned NOAA. We probably should redefine NOAA, even though we haven't...
National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So they any piece of weather data that gets distributed somehow, at least to the government end, passes through their hands.
Well, and almost all the commercial stuff does, too.
Yeah. You know, and even the private, a lot of the private stuff.
That's right. A lot of private commercial enterprises will let you believe that they run their own forecast models and all that, which they do, but they get all the information to plug into those models from the analysis that's done on the national and international scale in our country by NOAA. So, you know, it's not really private enterprise.
Well, with a lot of public help. Let's put
That's right.
We talked earlier in the year about Lewis.
Uccellini, right
there. Uccellini, UW grad, National Weather Service.
Yeah, he was here on Thursday.
Yes,
right,
Thursday night,
right after that rain.
Yep.
Giving a public talk, talking about the National Weather Service. A real Badger fan, talked about being a what NOAA is calling a weather-ready nation. So he pointed out how the national weather forecasting has improved, and some of the reasons of why that's improved, but also there's a lot of loss of life that still occurs. And so we need to find some way to work with everybody in terms of how to react to severe and threatening
weather. That's right. That's the interesting thing in my mind is that, you know, 20 years ago, even 15 years ago, the real challenge was getting the forecast right. That's not the primary challenge now. The primary challenge, and so it involves more people, is getting the word out and understanding how people absorb that information. So social scientists and people like that are an important part of the future of, you know, weather-ready preparedness.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
So that's what is the National Weather Service, is that what they're supposed to do, is kind of alert us? Or
well, their mission is protect life and property.
Right.
They do that for improved weather forecasting. And they have been improving over the ever since they've been in. And as an example, in 2005, you know, Katrina hitting the New Orleans area was forecasted 5 days before it happened.
That's right.
And yet there was still a lot of loss of life.
Yeah.
And so they're really looking at, okay, it's not just about making really accurate and precise forecasts. It's also about, you know, working with the public in taking appropriate actions.
Right.
And I think that's where they're really reaching out now to social scientists as well.
And, well, you guys are natural scientists, of course. How does what they do affect what you do in the way of research, or does it have any impact?
I think it does in some ways. Now, it doesn't directly impact the questions that I might wrestle with in my lab, although I know that I'm part of a bigger enterprise than I think I used to feel I was 20 years ago, in the sense that if I gain a new understanding of a phenomena, I'm kind of excited to see how it's going to hit the streets, publicly. It won't just be a splash in our own scientific journals and our own scientific conversations. It goes beyond that now. And I think we're building, in collaboration with such people, an informational infrastructure that allows these insights to actually have a pretty big impact more quickly than they used to in the past.
Yeah.
And that's exciting.
Yeah,
so in a sense, it does have an impact on the way one feels anyway about what one is doing as a research scientist.
Yeah, very cool. And Lewis, you said, talked about sort of what's going on compared to what used to go on in the way of forecasting and so forth.
Yeah, so one interesting thing he put up was the computer power that's been growing. And, you know, having better computer power means, or more computing power, means that you can handle certain physical processes better. You can approximate them better, and you can get to higher spatial and temporal resolutions, which he showed an example. I think it was for the forecast of Sandy storm that, you know, the higher resolution model spatial-wise, on the order of,
I think it was 15 kilometers,
resolution gave a better forecast than if you were at 30 kilometers, which is more likely.
Yeah, and these are the kind of questions that we could only speculate about. And again, I'll say, as recently as 15 years ago, and computer power has increased to the point where we can run them. They're expensive, so they don't tend to be the issued forecast. But that's going to change because everything's changing so fast. What did he say?
Yeah.
We got a 5 times increase in the rapidity of calculations.
She's right,
just this last year.
Yeah.
And that doesn't sound like a lot, but we're going from 200 billion calculations, 200 trillion per second to 1,000 or a quadrillion per second or something like that. Ridiculous amounts of power.
And think 10 years from now.
Yeah, you're right. Right.
Yeah,
I mean, it's unbelievable to even fathom.
And we've got it on your iPhone.
Right, and we got people on our own campus in the computer science department who are building that architecture. How are we going to do that?
Doing it right now.
It might not be little silicon chips. It'll be chemistry of another kind.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's
going to
be tomorrow.
Boy. We're talking all kinds of things here with our weather.
Weather touches everything.
It does.
Weather touches everything. Our UW weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, you can join in too at 1-800-642-1234. Has this summer felt normal or unusual for you? Any interesting weather phenomena that you've witnessed lately? And if you have some photos, we always love to see on my Facebook page some great weather photos. So if you've got some, please send them along. That's just go to the Larry Mueller Show. And you can do that. And if you also have a sure cure for a cold, please send that along immediately. Oh, man. Well, listen, we mentioned tornadoes, but I didn't talk about hurricanes.
Mm.
We didn't talk about hurricanes. Anything about what conditions need to be in place for a hurricane?
That's a good question. I would say it's maybe a better way to answer it is what conditions need to be absent in order to have a hurricane. Because the tropical atmosphere, it seems to me, is hostile to the formation of these things because there's a lot of things that can screw them up. One thing that's always present for a hurricane is a warm ocean surface that encourages a lot of evaporation and a lot of water vapor to be in the air after the evaporation. So the air is filled with water vapor. So that's a really good primary condition for hurricanes. But if there is a substantial difference in the wind speed and direction or one or the other over something as deep as 6 or 7 kilometers of depth in the atmosphere, and we're talking about maybe 10 meters per second, 20 mile per hour difference in the wind speeds from the ground to about 7 miles above the ground. If there's that much difference in the wind speed, forget it for a hurricane. It'll be squashed. And that's very easy to come by, as it turns out. It's what's difficult is to isolate the developing cluster of thunderstorms in a region where there isn't such a strong wind direction and speed change over that depth of the atmosphere. So that's why there's only, you know, half a dozen to a dozen of these storms every year, even in an active season, because most of the proto or sort of embryonic storms get squashed by one or another of these kind of environmental effects that are very toxic to them. Wind shear is one. The presence of dry air that comes off of the Sahara is another one. That's very in the Atlantic Basin. All kinds of different things can figure in and really screw around with the formation of a hurricane. So they're rare beasts.
That's really, well, that's a good thing.
Yeah, that is a good thing.
Yeah, that is a very good thing.
And they play an important role. They ventilate the tropical ocean. We need to have them happen, but nobody wants them happening in their backyard.
No, not in my backyard. We're talking.
That's why we live in Wisconsin.
Yeah, there you go.
Once in a while, we get sort of the tail end
we
of
get the tail.
Yeah, we can get heavy precip from them, yeah.
Yeah, winds and some rain. John Martin and Steve Ackerman, our guests, our weather guys from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Send a photo and a question to my Facebook page, at the Larry Mueller Show. Like the page while you're there. We'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. Back after the news. Well, there's never a shortage of things to talk about with our weather guys. Steve Ackerman and John Martin tell us what we've been experiencing weather-wise and what's on the horizon weather-wise as well, and certainly make me, I hope, and I'm pretty sure you too, a whole lot smarter about what goes on with our weather and climate. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. John, of course, a professor and past chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. 10 years is a long time in that position, I can tell you that right now. Steve Ackerman directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies and obviously professor in Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Guys, great to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Well, we have callers online with questions. I have questions. Let's go to Alex in Salem. Alex, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I called in last month, and I was asking about why storms like die around my house.
Right.
And I was wondering, if we're in like the middle of January, and we have a lot of snow, but a rare warm front brings like 60s and 70s and melts all the snow, would all the moisture that melted, would that increase the severeness of storms if we were going to have storms that day?
Oh, I see what you're asking. That's a good question. So, yeah, Alex, that's a good insight. The more water vapor, invisible water that's in the atmosphere, the more potent the convective storms will be. Those are the kind we usually think of as severe storms. Though they are rare in January, if you can somehow increase the amount of water vapor locally at a spot, you have a better chance of fueling those storms. So yes, indeed, that could exactly be one of the outcomes of such a series of events. You're exactly right. And the warm front itself will come along with a set of dynamical properties that can actually encourage the development of precipitation and maybe sometimes convective precipitation. So it not only provides the warmth and the wind that might help to do the evaporation, but it may also provide a dynamical seat for the development of the very storms that you're talking about.
Yeah. Okay. Now, would that increase the possibility of a tornado with all the heat, or would that be just due to wind and moisture?
Yeah, a tornado is going to depend on characteristics in the environment that are of a little bit larger scale than just the warmth and just the moisture. And very often those necessary characteristics are not so well put together near a warm front. So here you've got a bit of a limiting factor. You know, in January, you're going to have a devil of a time melting a lot of snow fast unless you're in a region of really strong temperature contrast where it's warm on one side, that's the warm front. But the vertical wind characteristics around the warm front are not quite optimal for the development of tornadoes. So there's a bit of a limiting factor there.
Oh, okay.
All right. Thanks. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So could that warm front or heat wave only last for a day? Could it like snow the next day and be in back into the 30s?
Yeah. If you're warming up at, say, Madison or West Salem, because of a warm front passage in January, it's very likely that within a day or two, you're going to get right back to regular January temperatures. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. I was thinking of a time going muskie fishing in October in northern Wisconsin, and the first day we were there, it was we had about 8 inches of snow.
Hmm.
And the next day, we were in shorts and no shirts on.
I'll bet a lot of times, too, in January and February, when you get that warm weather, you generate fog.
Lots of fog.
That's dangerous.
It is. Yeah.
We've got a photo here up on my Facebook page. I hope everybody gets a chance to look at it. This is from John, who said, I just learned about Kelvin Helmholtz cloud structures recently, and then I saw some over Williams Bay, Wisconsin, on Geneva Lake. Only one structure in this photo, and it disappeared almost as fast as it formed. Very interesting. What is a Kelvin Helmholtz cloud structure?
Yeah, in the atmosphere, we have waves. You know, a lot of times it's easier to picture waves because they're in the atmosphere, they're invisible, is to think of waves on water. Like waves on water, you can get wind-driven waves, you can get gravity waves. And Kelvin Helmholtz waves are a type of instability where the wave forms and breaks. And it looks very much like your classic wave that's breaking on the ocean or that, you know, a cartoonist might sketch in terms of a wave. There have been some really nice cases of these waves where you see a bunch of them lined up. But in this photo, really in the center, way down at the bottom, just above where the land is. You can see this classic wave feature. And that's what the Kelvin Helmholtz wave looks like. I don't know if that would actually be one. That could be just a regular cloud formation, though.
That's kind of what I'm beginning to suspect the more I look at it. I think there's some Castellanus, some cumulonimbus Castellanus, the kind that grow the little turrets on the top. And in this case, we're not seeing all the filament fall out. But these are irregular-looking perturbations to the top part of the cloud, and in a really nice Kelvin Helmholtz, they look very regular.
They're very regular.
It's almost like somebody drew them in the sky. I mean, it's that regular.
You get very repetitive patterns.
Yeah, so there's a chance that I think the one you're drawing attention to is the only one that maybe is a chance, but it's in a convective environment. Makes me think that's probably not quite what happened in this case.
It could be just a vertical motion that gets sheared out.
Yeah, that's right.
But no cigar.
Yeah.
So keep looking.
Yeah, because when you see a really vivid example, boy, it'll take your breath away, no doubt.
Bob and Eau Claire, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good.
Good. You?
And Larry, I feel your pain, man.
Thanks, Bob.
I hope you're taking lots of lozenges and keeping hydrated. Okay. Speaking of hydration, here's a segue. In the Eau Claire area in June, we were at a surplus of 14 to 15 inches coming out of that really wet spring. And in today's Leader Telegram, they've got the almanac, and it shows us still up for the year at 6 inches. But if you look anywhere else, you know, take your eye off the paper and look around at what's going on, it is dry as a bone here.
Yeah.
Of course, we're in sandy country here, and the sand doesn't hold anything. So what my question is, now last year we had a classic drought and a lot of trees were under major stress. And now they're being put through another round of stress now. How long can they endure these types of deprivations before they just say, I can't go on?
Hmm.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's probably going to be related to the types of trees, you know, in the sense that if they're imported trees, you know, that we all, and plants that we often bring in to decorate our homes, that they might have a problem. But more of the ones that have grown up in here are used to, you know, getting into a situation where, again, it's not good for them, but we probably won't have a whole mass die-off of.
Yeah, that's right. I think they're more prone to insect pests or various other things than many of the species are than they are to drought, because what we consider a drought, because we're keeping care of our lawn and our agriculture and even agriculture now, last year's drought didn't kill the corn that it would the way it would have in 1920. I mean, it would have been unbelievable devastation in 1920 as opposed to 2012. But, you know, the droughts that we perceive are, I think we perceive them to be worse than they actually are for these various species. They seem to be able to handle it, and they can really manage what's going on. But you're right. I mean, more important sometimes in the total amount of precipitation is how it's distributed, and you know, over the course of the calendar year. And so we're all way ahead by the end of June or end of July. But now August has been dry, and I think it has stressed some trees around, even in Madison. So it's you know, that we were commenting on earlier. It's very interesting.
Yeah. And I looked at the drought index yesterday as well before coming over here, and it's not going to get really bad, but they're looking at it to be continuing drying, particularly in the western part of Wisconsin. Mm. So that Eau Claire region, again, is looking to get into not a really bad drought, but still definitely a dry period over the next couple of months.
Yeah, it's interesting. They always seem to succumb first, so maybe it is the sandiness of the soil, how the water just runs right through it.
It definitely could be the case. Another Bob in Minocqua is a weather observer for NOAA in Minocqua area. Hmm. He went 28 days from July 24th through August 21st without a high temperature of 80.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Last night at 9 o'clock, it was 82 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
Strange year.
Oh, last night?
Yesterday's
high here in town was 88. And if you had asked a person on the street, they would have said, oh, it's got to be in the mid-90s. Because we just haven't been that warm this year. Yeah. And everybody would have mistaken it, I think. I know I would have. Amazing.
Don emailed and wonders, with so many smartphones, any good apps you can download to your phone which would give warnings to severe weather in an area?
Actually, I do have I have an iPhone, and I do have an app that I think comes from the National Weather Service, and I'm going to quickly look up in here and see where it is. And it gives me warnings. Yeah, actually, it's the weather radio.
Oh, yeah?
They moved it, you know, NOAA has a weather radio that you can sign up for,
And
now they have an app, too. So if you search on weather radio, it's a free app, and it'll give you warnings for both where you're located, as well as if you specify particular cities. So I remember being in Virginia at one point, and it's beautiful outside, and then my weather app went off, and I was like, what the heck? And there was a storm moving into Wisconsin.
Wisconsin
was going under a warning.
Todd in Wausau,
that's a really good thing.
Wonders what causes these hot days toward the end of August. Is it part, you know, it happens every year, kind of. Is it part of La Nina, or?
No, it's just, you know, it's a matter of what I like to think of is of energy gains versus energy losses. And as long as we, or any object, gains more energy than it loses, it's going to heat up. And we get most of our energy and heat from the sun, and we lose it. Again, so you can see my research bias radiatively back out to space. And that gain versus that loss results in maximum gains or gains continuing up until late August or so before we start moving around to energy losses.
Yeah.
Of course, it's a lot more complicated than that.
If you look at a 1,000-year time series, you'd see this beautiful curve that would fit your story. And you know, if you look at 1 year, you're going to have big perturbations around that curve, but that's the way it is.
And that's what we call an annual cycle.
Yeah.
And the daily cycle, 24-hour cycle, we call a diurnal cycle, and it's the same thing. Energy gains give us hot temperatures up until about 1 or 2 o'clock.
Well, Marcus in Green Bay has a question for you. Marcus, hi.
Hi, I'm calling about dew point, but also, two callers ago, if you type in NOAA, they have apps for the smartphone and iPhone for weather alerts. So NWS, NOAA or something, that's how I got mine.
Yeah, and they also have a radar one, too, I'm pretty sure.
We can probably post those.
Yeah,
all sorts of neat stuff. But so, yeah, the dew point, I don't know, it wasn't that long ago when, you know, the weather forecasters, it was all about the humidity, you know. You remember, it's not the heat, it's the humidity, and now we're really concentrating on the dew point, and I think that's kind of neat, you know, all the advances we make, and you guys were just talking about the big computers and what's to come. So, I don't know, just talk about that a little bit, how the weather people are now really focusing on, it gets it, you know, gives us a handle, you know, tomorrow or today is going to, the dew point's going to be 71 or something, we can get an idea about it, and it seems more accurate than just humidity.
Yeah, it actually is one of several humidity measurement variables, but it's the one that has the least popular, let's say, exposure up to this point. Although I agree with you, I'm glad it's increasing, because I think it's also the one that gives the best indication of human comfort at a glance. As soon as the number is dropped, everybody knows where they stand, and everybody has a slightly different comfort level. For me, if I hear a dew point of 65 or higher, I am saying, you know, I'm staying inside and I'm going to avoid getting out in the heat, in the humidity, because it's going to be oppressive. Everyone agrees with that over 70 for a dew point. And, you know, on the other hand, if it's 50 or below, almost nobody complains about the air being both warm, if it might be warm, as well as too muggy. So it's a really great way to measure human comfort. And what it is defined as is it's the temperature to which you'd have to cool the air. You go outside right now and you can feel that it's soupy outside. You might imagine, I wonder how cool I have to make this air before the invisible water vapor starts to condense into liquid water. The temperature at which that starts to happen is the dew point. And so on a day like today, you know that's not going to be very much cooling required. You can tell there's a lot of water vapor in there. Middle of winter, there's no water vapor at all. You'll have to cool it forever before you get anything to condense.
Very interesting. Marcus, thanks very much for calling and for that comment. You know, sort of another comment sort of about the weather and what we do give and don't give in terms of weather information. Ann was wondering in an email what happened to air quality alert days. We used to seem to have at least a couple of in Dane County, for example, every summer, but it's been several years since she has heard that an air quality alert day has been declared.
I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Because they still give them out.
Yeah.
They still do them.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think now that I think the last ones that I've heard are generally associated with cities like Milwaukee or
Chicago for sure.
Or Chicago for sure.
And then it takes a summer like last summer where it's hot and humid a lot of the time to really, you know, have quite a number of them so that by the time the summer's over, you'd say, yeah, it seemed like we had four or five of them all summer. And maybe the true answer was 10.
Right.
But you'd remember four or five of them. I don't think we've had too many this summer, though. And
no,
we've
I don't
all
think
commented as one way to characterize the summer. It's been cooler and substantially less humid than most summers, except for, you know, days like today.
And I'm trying to think. We probably had one. I mean, they also issue air qualities when smoke from fires comes into an area, too.
Yeah. So that's right.
But again, we haven't really hit that, at least at the surface. Maybe
that's
been
right.
up high, but not down low.
Jamie in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We noticed we're in Green Bay, and we went to the lakeshore to get cooler over the weekend, drove towards Algoma, and we noticed that, like, within about a block, I was watching the thermometer on my car. It went from 89 to 69 within about a block.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Lake Michigan.
Incredible how, how quickly the temperature changed. It was almost like there was a vertical wall there. And I was wondering why you don't see more severe weather along that break.
Very good question. And it points to just how deep the structures really have to be to organize severe weather in the atmosphere, because what you drove through is dramatic. There's no one on Earth who would deny the drama of a 20-degree temperature drop, you know, over about five city blocks. That's really dramatic. But I bet you it's not very deep. And as a consequence, there's no particularly organized dynamical structure that comes along with that through any particularly deep part of the atmosphere or layer of the atmosphere, and so it can't really organize severe weather. It's probably just the depth.
Yeah, and you can see this. I know Ann, my wife and I were driving along the Lake Michigan shoreline about a week ago, and not only can you see the temperature change in your car, but if you look at the cloud conditions as well, you'll notice that when you're in that cold air, up above is clear. And to the west where it's warmer, you'll see these stratocumulus cumulus clouds. Mm-hmm. So they're not very deep.
Yeah.
And that's just marking, again, where that warm air is and where that cold is. Occasionally, you will get enough uplift, as John was alluding to, and get a thunderstorm
right
off of that lake breeze. But a lot of times you don't.
And sometimes the circumstances that you saw, I would say they were probably in isolation from any other larger scale structure in the atmosphere. But that's not always true. Sometimes some bigger, well, much better organized cold front, which by itself might not be able to really trigger severe weather, in conjunction with that kind of a low-level boundary that you drove through, that combination can give something some life and really get the weather organized in a way that either one of them by themselves wouldn't be able to do. So it's really quite interesting.
Yeah. Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you. Hope you feel better, Larry.
Yeah, thank you very much. I hope so, too. Daniel in Minog, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hello. Noticeably in Wisconsin the last few years, and in the South also, we've had violent swings in weather year to year. Record warmth, record cold, record droughts, record precipitation. Why have the swings in weather become so extreme? Why the huge oscillations?
That's a good question. There's some theories out there that, first of all, take your statement as an observed fact, as a premise. I have to still be on the side that says I'm not so sure the jury is in on that. I don't think we can say with certainty that we have more extreme fluctuations from year to year than we used to have. If one takes that premise as, or takes that statement as a premise for an argument, there was a paper published a couple of years ago that seemed to suggest some reasons why there might be increased blocking events that lead to like 2-week weather regimes in certain locations, either heat waves or cold waves in the wintertime, for instance. And then a recent paper by somebody we know from Colorado State came out and said, no, there's really nothing to that. So the state of the science is, first of all, it's not clear that people in our science agree that things have become more extreme in a systematic, testable, significant way. And secondly, there's not really an available theory yet that's been developed that explains how these differences from year to year really do fit into something that's maybe somewhat unusual that's going on in the background. We're not so sure about either of those points yet. Mm. So it's a hard question for me to answer. I know Steve probably has some opinions too.
Well, I was thinking more of, back to the observations in like 2012, and again, that was a big drought year for the nation, but a lot of maximum temperature records across the state. But again, that was part of a big drought time phenomenon, and so I guess it's not so surprising.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking also in the 30s, there were also a lot of record temperatures set again. So again, the extreme values were occurring back in the 30s during the Dust Bowl eras, again was also a drought time period. So yeah, I don't know if we really compared what's happening now in the 2010 decades, if you will, back to the 1930s in terms of record.
Yeah, it's a good point, because in World War II years in Europe were bitterly cold. They were unusually cold. After the 30s in Europe were also unusually warm. So, this kind of fluctuation has occurred in the past, and in a past where it's not quite as likely that industrialization or something like that is really underlying it. There may be something else to it.
Yeah. Thanks, Daniel, for calling. Appreciate it. Karen in Edgerton said, thanks to you guys who talked a lot about clouds last month. I'm reading a wonderful book. It's called The Cloud Spotter's Guide by Gavin Pretoria Penny.
Mm. Yeah, I like that book. I got that on my shelf.
Yeah. She's also got a cloud app, too. So
she does. Well, she should get our satellite app. It's called SatCam, if she has an iPhone. We haven't done it for the Android yet. But yeah, it'll you make cloud observations and you take pictures with your iPhone, and then when the satellite comes over, it'll half an hour to an hour after it goes over, it'll send you a picture of what the clouds look from the satellite, and it'll give you a little blue dot of where you are.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's a cool app.
Yeah, that is a very cool app. What's it called again?
It's called SatCam, SatCam.
On that note, we're done. We'll see you guys in September.
All righty.
Thanks a lot. John Martin and Steve Ackerman, our guests, our weather guys, they'll be back the last Monday of September, and we'll do it all over again with them. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.